Blog Talk Radio.
Chatting the Share is presented by the Writers and Illustrators of the Future. They have been providing a means for new and budding writers to have a chance for their creative efforts to be seen and acknowledged. Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today we're talking with author Therese Derwin. This is a recorded broadcast, so please don't call in. Please enjoy. Teresa, welcome to the show.
Hi, Sherry. Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, I'm really excited to have you here. I hope you enjoyed our little chat.
Yes, definitely.
let's the audience get to know you a little bit. What kind of books do you like to read? What did you like to read as a kid?
Well, that kind of changed over the years. It's an interesting question, because when I was at school, it was all very basic, Peter and Jane, you know, walk up a hill, that kind of thing. And I got pretty bored. But as I discovered the library in our secondary school, and I met teachers who were a little bit different, they would introduce me to lots of different books. I had one teacher give me the speeches of Martin Luther King, which was a bit unusual because I was 14 at the time. And then I was massively into TV and film, and my gateway into it was through second-hand bookshop and reading film and TV tie-ins, which I basically read all of the Star Trek Next Generation novels as a kid. And that was how I got into a lot of reading. So it was pretty much geeky to begin with.
That's interesting. Yeah, I was... It's funny because when you said that, I was thinking, here it's called Dick and Jane, but I guess that wouldn't be appropriate for children in Britain.
Yeah.
But there goes Dick and Jane.
Yeah, I don't think so. Not in the UK.
But I'm sort of the same about the tie-in. I used to, like, the first books I loved that were real books to read were Ellery Queen. And the reason I wanted to read them was there was a TV series called Ellery Queen with Jim Hutton that I just adored. So my parents would buy me the books.
I used to basically ask for my pocket money. I don't know what you call it over there, allowance.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go and I had to ask for a raise to go up to £2 so that I could actually afford a paperback at the bookshop. And I started off, I think one of the earliest ones I bought was the film novelisation by Craig Shaw Gardner, I think, of The Lost Boys, which was one of my sort of formative films as a youth. So I adored all of that stuff. And the tie-ins, you could just keep those characters you loved in your head for so many more hours than just watching a film.
I used to think of it as sort of like an extension, because you get so much more, like from the Star Trek tie-ins from when I was a kid.
I loved them.
They were like, You would know what Kirk, especially you know what Spock was thinking, because Spock hardly told you what he was thinking. So it was kind of cool. So you got Spock's thoughts about what was going on in his head during this and stuff. Even during the movies they did that. And it was like, especially the first movie, when they did when they seemed not to like each other, which confused me. They gave a lot more information, and you found out who, you know, that the reason Kirk was so pissed off was that he just broke up with his girlfriend, and they were supposed to get married, and there was a whole backstory to what was going on with Kirk and why he was so angry at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I still read tie-ins now, and there's so much more the writers can do with them once they've got a script or an idea in their hands.
One of my favorites was because it was written by the same person who wrote the movie, but it was, I just loved the book version of Romancing the Stone.
Oh my god, me too.
I thought it was so brilliant because you found out what Joan was thinking and what I can't remember what the man, Michael Douglas's character.
Yeah, oh god, I can never remember him. I love Joan.
Yeah.
Joan Wilder!
Joan Wilder! Oh my god, Joan Wilder! Michael was. That was the closest to his dad that he ever got in the movie.
Yes.
I really think so. If you watch the movie, you see a lot of Kirk Douglas in his performance.
Oh, God, yes, absolutely. And that wonderful chin.
Yep.
And kind of gruff hero.
Yeah, it was interesting because he, like you said, for a long time he played the sweet, sensitive guy because he wanted to stay as far away from his father's type of characterization as he could. But when I saw that, I went, wow, he can be sexy.
He really was. I mean, in Wall Street, obviously he's not, but he's very good at being a baddie.
Oh, yeah.
But when you see him in Romancing the Stone, like, woo! He was one of my early crushes, along with Kurt Russell.
Oh, yeah, Kurt Russell.
Speaking of which, I think they're making or talking about remaking
Escape from New York. I know, they're like remaking my entire childhood.
It's ridiculous.
It's everything. They're even doing Fantasy Island as a horror movie.
I know. It's not got great reviews, I understand.
I could deal with Charlie's Angels as long as John Forsythe was Charlie. I don't want to see the new Charlie's Angels. There's no cohesiveness in it if there's nobody from the original film. I mean, from the original series.
If you haven't got a new story to tell, or can make changes that make it resonate with today's society, I don't see the point in remaking it.
Yeah, exactly. I don't. I mean, they're fine young actresses. I have nothing against them. Why couldn't you do another show, a totally original show about three strong women? I mean, why do you have to do Charlie's Angels? Why can't...
Yeah.
We've already had it. We had it as the original series. We had a really good movie series with the three of them. Why do it again? And so soon?
I mean, yeah, it just seems to be 2 minutes later and the new version of another one like Spider-Man.
Yeah.
How many iterations of that have there been?
And Batman. They keep redoing it different. And I'm like, you know, the first movie was good. The first movie was okay. The second movie was really good.
Did you were Michael Keaton girl?
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. They keep doing it and then doing different bad guys and stuff. And I'm like, I like comic books, but can't you guys come up with use some of the new comic books?
Yeah.
Why are you using the classics? Why don't you use some of the new stuff?
Yeah, do something different.
That's the part that bothers me, really, is that... the creativity, there's a lot of creativity to go in that, but the originality. I mean, really, in major motion stuff from major movie studios, the only thing that's really original, and I'm not talking about independent films because they're all wonderful and original.
Yes. Yeah.
But I'm talking about major movie studios that are doing their own films. The only thing that's original is animated films.
Oh, God, they're fantastic now.
Yeah.
I really want to see Onward with the Unicorn.
Yeah, I mean, and the Frozen series and all these other things, they're really adorable and original and really cool concepts and great actors doing the voices. Why can't they do that for live action?
I don't understand it myself. I mean, I've just done my first screenplay last term at uni.
Mm-hmm.
I'm off to a film festival this weekend, Starburst International Film Festival, and there's lots of indie filmmakers there, and there seem to be a lot more original ideas and takes on stuff. But you're right about the big houses, the big studios. It's just about churning out what they can, which doesn't give the best material necessarily for the actors, the directors, the crew.
Yeah, the thing is that the old movie studios had many problems. Absolutely.
Yeah.
They did. But those guys loved movies. They loved creativity. They had guts. They put their money in creating incredible comedy, drama, musical, whatever it was. They were all wonderful. They did it because they were passionate about it. They weren't. They were as interested in money as they are today, but it was like balanced with really good product. You know, and that's what's missing.
Yeah, I mean, I feel sorry for a lot of the indies, and I know quite a few screenwriters in the UK at the minute, and it's just hard getting somebody to look at a script and take a risk on it. And I think Netflix is doing some interesting things, because they're taking a few gambles.
Netflix
on the TV shows.
Netflix and HBO, those are the markets.
Yeah, I like HBO, yeah.
HBO has, from the beginning, has always taken risks on stuff.
Yeah, we used to call it the hot bodies only channel.
Yeah, they did have a lot of soft porn.
They did.
Yeah, I remember.
You can't argue with them.
But that paid for the original stuff that they put on later.
Yes.
So, you know, as kind of icky that part was, and it was, I actually saw my first soft porn on HBO. I was I was in college, and I was at my parents' house, and they had just gotten HBO, and I don't even remember the name of the movie because it was really bad. And I was like watching it, and I was sitting with it was really funny because it was my mom, my dad, my brother, and I.
And
it was really, we were just watching it because we were curious. Because it was like, it was beginning of HBO, so that would have been like 90s.
Yeah.
And my brother was, I was in university, he was in his first year of community college. And I came home from work, and I was like, what are you guys doing? And Dad goes, you won't believe what they have on this new pay-per-view thing. And I said, oh? And he put it on, and oh my God, that's pornography, because it's soft porn.
Yeah.
That's what Dad said before. It's soft porn. It's
really
not real.
Then I was watching True Blood, and kind of like into the first episode, I'm like, oh, that's a bit naughty. And I'm watching it with my dad. He's 85. He's sitting next to me at the moment, and it's like really, really embarrassing. But dad's like, ignore them, you know.
But the funny thing is, compared to the movies that were coming out, it wasn't a big deal.
I know, it was just a shock coming on your TV.
Yeah, it was really, because that was one of the things I was saying to my parents when we were watching it. I'm like, I can't remember, it was one movie that had just Last Tango in Paris, I think?
Yeah.
Or something like that. It was one of those really, and this was with major movie stars, pornographic movies, and it was much more pornographic than that. The feature film was much more pornographic than the soft porn. And I was like, this is crap. The writing's terrible. The acting's terrible. And you never get to see the guy's body. It's all the woman. It's really boring to me. And I went upstairs and did homework. I think I was there for about 20 minutes.
I don't blame you. So, I mean, I don't want to talk about Mr. Grey, as it were. The only Mr. Grey I know is from Stephen King films. But the ones here, I think I watched 40 minutes of the first 50 Shades of whatever. And I was like, oh my God, this is awful.
I haven't actually seen it. I had no interest.
I'm terribly excited. I sit through a film, and if the writing is bad or the directing is bad, I can't cope with it.
And I never blame the actors, because they can only do what's written in the script or whatever the production is, you know. Because they're the face of the movie. It's really not fair to put it all on them. And that's what a lot of the critics do. Even now, I was reading some critiques of some films, and I was like, this is not fair. You're putting it all on the actor. It's not right.
Yeah. It really is a shame. I mean, the guy Dorman or something like that.
Oh, he's such a sweetheart. Jamie Dorman. He's a nice guy. And he's a good actor. I've seen him in other stuff. It's just really terrible that they're blaming him.
If you've got bad material, there's not a lot you can do with it. Only ham it up a bit.
But he's gotten opportunities from this that he may not have gotten if he didn't play this character.
That's a very interesting point. Sometimes you've got to go with something off a conveyor belt if you want a chance of getting that next gig.
Yeah. I mean, Paul Newman did a movie. I'm trying to remember which movie it is. He took an ad out in the Daily Variety saying that he was really sorry that he was in this horrible film, and please don't not hire him for the next movie because he was in this piece of you know what.
Yeah. I don't blame him, bless him.
I can't remember what movie it was one of the biblical ones.
Oh God.
I think was it The Robe? Something.
Oh.
Which was not that best biblical movie they ever made.
No, there's a lot of, there's some bad and some good out there with the biblical movies. Of course, it's coming up to Easter, and in the UK, that means every channel
here
is showing Jesus Nazareth, and Jesus of Nazareth, and the Ten Commandments, which I like, to be honest, I'm a fan of that one.
Well, Ten Commandments is beautifully made. Are you talking about the original with Charlton Heston? And
yeah, that's the one I'm on about, yeah. Great film. Dad loves all of that.
Yeah.
So we try to mix it up with horror for me, enough to do research and to get my fix. He indulges me the romance when I'm writing romance. And then I'll find some classics for him. We watched McClintock the other day.
I love old movies. I am such an old movie fan. Give me a Cary Grant movie and I'm happy.
Yeah.
Any Cary Grant movie.
Belle Friday, I think, is one of my favorites.
Bringing a Baby.
Oh.
He's so adorable in that. I just went gay all of a sudden.
The one on the ship with all the school teachers, and they're stranded on the island. God, I can't remember the title, but he has to look after the French school teacher.
Oh, Father Goose is one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Father Goose, that's a great movie. See Cary Grant as you've never seen him before. Scruffy. He loved that. He loved that movie.
Yeah.
Did you know he produced it?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, Grantley, next time you watch it, look for Grantley Productions. That was his production company.
That
one, and I actually really love his last movie, Walk, Don't Run, even though he wasn't the romantic character in it. He's just so funny.
He was a very funny actor. He really was.
And he was beautiful. He aged great. There's not many people who age as beautifully as Cary Grant aged.
No, no. I think Paul Newman aged well. I was a real Steve McQueen fan.
Well, he didn't age.
No,
he died young.
I thought he was quite good.
Oh, I always loved him.
Douglas fan.
I love so many. Robert Wagner, I still like him.
Yeah.
And Pierce Brosnan.
Yes.
He's beautiful.
He's one of my favorite Bonds.
I love him as Bond, but I loved him in Remington Steele.
Oh, I love that. Yes. Love Remington Steele.
I love that series. It was one of the first shows that they weren't married and they were complete equals.
Yes, and it was also kind of showing, look, this is what women have to put up with in order to
Yeah, in order to make it in the profession that they wanted to do.
Fake male identity.
Yeah, I mean, she created a whole character.
Yeah.
She gave him an apartment. He had an office. I mean, it was all fake. The office, the apartment, that was all her imagination. He redecorated Remington when he came in.
Speaking of that kind of thing, I love moonlighting. That was one of my favorite ones.
Oh, yeah.
With Bruce Willis before, well, possibly when he had hair.
He did have hair. He had a full head.
Yeah, Sybil Shepherd was one of my icons.
Oh, Sybil was wonderful in that series. I also liked her in Sybil.
Yeah.
She was really cool.
Olivia Wick was her daughter, or am I going completely nuts?
Who?
Olivia Wick.
Yeah, that was the younger daughter.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what's her name? Michelle Pfeiffer's daughter was her older daughter. Deborah Pfeiffer? Something like
that. I don't remember, but Dee Dee Pfeiffer was the sister. Now, she was in a classic horror film that I looked back with Grace Jones and Robert Russell. That's a cracking little film.
Mm.
I like Dee Dee Pfeiffer, but I don't remember the name of Michelle's daughter.
Yeah, that's a... No, was it Fifi? Or something... Fifi Pfeiffer. Maybe it was Fifi Pfeiffer. I think it was something like that. She was adorable. I loved her in that show. She was really a good... I haven't seen her in anything else. I mean, Alicia went on to do a lot of other stuff, but I don't remember her doing anything else after Sybil. But she was really good in Sybil. It was a shame that she didn't go on to other stuff. But I love that. I love good TV shows. I still watch Xena. I still watch Relic Hunter. Yep. I still watch Star Trek, a classic Star Trek and Star Trek Next Generation.
Need Catch Picard.
I haven't seen it because I don't have the Prime thing, the streaming service. This time they didn't even, when they showed Discovery, at least they showed the first episode on regular CBS, but when they did Picard, it's all on there. There is nothing. It's not on regular CBS, so I haven't seen it. And I have a friend who's, he might direct some. At least I could see Discovery by getting the DVD so I could see his stuff that he's directing. But I don't know if I'm ever going to see Picard unless they get that on DVD because...
I'll tell you what, I'll have a little conversation with you offline about how to watch shows. And I'm saying now else. But there are ways and means. But, I mean, I speak of TV, but most people who know me know I'm obsessed by Supernatural.
Oh.
I met Jared Padalecki a couple of years ago, and it was amazing. Such a nice guy. It was, it was absolutely lovely, and that's coming to an end now.
My new show is, I have a lot of shows, but I love two shows that are on. Neither of them are American.
Yeah.
One is Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries.
Yes.
And the other one is My Life is Murder.
Oh, no, I don't know that one.
Oh, it's with Lucy Lawless in the lead.
Oh, that sounds good.
It's really good. It's actually the most like Lucy I've ever seen her be.
Really?
Yeah, it's a little bit rougher and more not as sweet as the real Lucy, but it's, I mean, because she's the character. But, yeah, it's really good. I mean, people put her to a really high standard because she's done some really good stuff, you know, like Battlestar Galactica and stuff like that. But, you know, it's a murder mystery. Stop comparing it to Battlestar Galactica.
they're all different. Each genre, each program, each book, each piece of entertainment, they're all kind of, you can't put them on a level if they're completely different genres.
Exactly. And I really enjoyed it. I mean, I watched all, and it's renewed, so I'm really happy that I get to see it. But it's, there's 10 episodes. That is on Acorn, if you got Acorn, the streaming service.
I've got so many, it's insane how many kind of mediums and streaming devices and stuff that I pay for now.
Isn't it sad? Because we also pay for cable.
Yeah, exactly. But I think Netflix is one of my favourite, and Amazon Prime is starting to up their game. Carnival Row was very good.
Oh, Amazon Prime has Miss Fisher. So you could watch that if you haven't seen it. And the new movie that just came out, Miss Fisher and the Crypt of Tears, is also on Amazon. So you've got to see that.
Really, what I love. I remember when I did my postgrad, I did an assignment on Egyptology and Napoleon and all of that. And it's, just that whole, I wanted to be Indiana Jones when I was...
Yeah, me too. Well, I studied archaeology not because of Indiana Jones, but because of my love of history. But I remember my first class in archaeology at the university, and my teacher came in and she goes, I don't wear a fedora, I don't have a whip. She goes, and I don't take you guys out on my expeditions, and it's funny. It was almost, part of it was almost like his thing. It's all research and library and stuff that he says. But she goes, because I was a research assistant my second year for her, and I said to her, you are Indiana Jones. You just won't admit it.
Yeah, that is so cool.
Yeah.
I wanted to do archaeology, but when it came down to it, it was English that, you know, I went for in the end, and I'm glad I did.
But the funny thing is that there's, because I was a huge history buff, it was a natural progression for me to want to find out as much about archaeology as I can, the study of ancient man. So one of the novels I'm working on is about an archaeologist, based a lot about not only on my old professor, but a bunch of stuff that happened to me when I was in archaeology, and a good mystery. But that's a while away, because I'm still working on it. Do you ever get caught that you, like, you write yourself in a little hole that you have to dig yourself out of?
Yeah, that's
where I am right now.
Yeah, mine has been 26 years and going deeper. But no, I've just had so many other things to get done. And sometimes you get stuck, then all of a sudden, somebody will say something and click, you'll have the fix or the idea.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's like the book that I'm working on that's coming out. That started as a childhood thing that happened in my childhood that I made into expanded and made into science fiction. But it's taken years. I mean, I started when my father was still with us, so it had to be around 2005 or 2006, and I'm just getting published now.
Do you want to tell me about that while I've got you here, or while you've got me here? I'd like to hear a little bit about that.
Well, it is about, it's a lot about me in it, so God forgive me. It's about a young girl who is 9 years old, and she's from California, and she moved to Ohio, and she had never, she traveled with her parents, so it wasn't like she'd never been outside of California before, but she'd never lived outside of California before. So it was incredible culture shock, and they were treating her like she was from another planet.
Yeah.
And they used a line that was said to me when she first met some of the kids. They said, "Well, you're not blonde-haired and tanned. You can't be from California."
Oh,
which
yeah.
I wasn't. I was pale. I still am pale and freckled, and I have dark black hair. Well, now it's got gray in it. But then it was dark black hair. So. Just the horrible thing about being a new kid, you're picked on a lot.
Oh, yeah.
So she was trying to avoid the other kids. And so she went through the creek in order to get home. It's a different route than the normal going down the street. And so she went down through the creek, and she and her brother had explored the creek, and there was a bridge to go over to go to the other side. And because even though the creek was very low, she didn't want to get wet. And so she and her brother climbed over, and her mother had told her not to do it, not because they were worried about the water, because it was still summer, high to summer. But because they were worried a brick would loosen and she would fall and hurt herself.
Yeah.
Well, lo and behold, she goes there and the brick loosens and she falls down. And she's knocked out just for a minute, and she wakes up and she sees what looks like an angel over her. Like a bright, sparkling looking girl who looked like about the same age as her. And she thought she was dead, which she wasn't. And it turned out that she was one of the Children of the Light. The name of the book is Sandy and the Children of the Light.
Right.
And they live underground. And she saw her from their opening that's on the other side of the bridge. And she came out to help her. And that's the beginning of the story.
That sounds really good for me. That really does. I like a good bit of thought or fantasy. That, you know, I really get into those, with the worlds and all of that.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. My friend who does my illustrations, she's done all my illustrations, and I was very exacting about where the Children of the Light lived and what it looked like and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And she sent me like is this okay? I mean, she's never sent me so many versions because, and I'm not an artist, so mine is all like O's with little X's and like little markings and writings around it. This is this.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel sorry for the cover artist, really. You know, they've got to transform your ideas.
Especially when it's so specific.
Yes.
And it's, do you get stuff in dreams? Because I get ideas in my dreams.
Oh, God, all the time.
It's so weird.
I have the most random dreams.
Mine are very vivid.
Yeah.
Even, I mean, I had once, told one of my friends who was another writer that a lot of my best short stories that people love the most were from dreams. And I said they were very vivid, and I was still in college, and he says, "Well, when you grow older that will weaken, that's what my mom told me." And when I came home, I told my dad, and he said, no, why should your dreams weaken because you're older? That means you're losing your imagination. I don't see you ever losing your imagination.
Oh, that's... I feel sorry for people who do.
Because if you start losing your imagination and you start losing your dreams, what is there?
Yeah, exactly.
Especially in the world today. You need it.
You do. Definitely.
You know? So, I want to be able to chat about your book. What's the name of the book?
Right, The latest one I've got out is a short collection, and it's called Hearts and Bones. And it's out by Domain Publishing in the UK. It's currently ebook, but it will have a paperback out in the next month or so. And it's two kind of linked stories in respect of theme. One is a dog in the middle of a post-apocalyptic setting, kind of my answer to Harlan Ellison's Boy and a Dog, but more like a girl and a dog. And the other one is there's a great deal of folk horror in the UK, and the one that I did, it's my version of Partridge in a Pear Tree from the Christmas poem, and it's basically a cider factory where things go a little bit wrong, and a guy who does some very horrible things to bring the harvest back. So it's kind of about rebirth and death. Nice and cheerful.
Rebirth and death, that's happy.
That's just the latest one. But I've got a novella that I should have finished by the end of the summer. That's for Crystal Lake. That's a cheerful end of the world, post-apocalyptic sexually transmitted disease story.
Oh yeah, that sounds really for Christmas.
Yeah, I try to keep a little bit of fun in the books, but there's a lot of material out there at the minute in the world we're living in to help us write some really dark stuff.
Yeah, we have a mutual friend, Lee Murray, and we were talking about how all the different things that are happening in the world is sort of lending to horror, science fiction, mysteries, because there's so much happening that's, it's like the comedians have all this great material, too, because everything's happening, you know.
Exactly. It's all out there at the minute. I love Lee and her stuff. She's been a really good help to me with my writing, actually.
She's a very supportive lady.
Very, very much so. And you have to be if you're a woman in an industry where people have expected you to use pseudonyms or initials for the first 100 years.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
We're coming out of the proverbial closet.
I know. At a science fiction convention, I had the honor of sitting next to Dorothy Fontana.
Oh, cool.
She's such a nice lady. So nice. And I said, we both were there early. And it's like, you know, it's like kismet.
Yeah. Oh, I love that.
Empty room. Nobody there. Just the two. We were both on a panel together. And it was an empty room.
Yeah.
And just the two of us. And I said, I just want to let you know, first of all, that I so respect you, and I have 1,000 questions that I don't know if the guests will, you know, the people in the convention will ask. Can I ask you a few questions? And she was so nice to me.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, she was such an architect to Star Trek.
Yeah.
But, D.C. Fontana.
Yeah, I mean, God rest her. It wasn't long ago that
she just passed recently.
Away, I believe.
Yeah, she was such a nice lady. I was so shocked, but at least I met her.
Yeah.
I sat next to her.
Well,
I talked to her.
That is something. I mean, to have met her, that's a really cool thing.
Yeah, she was really, really nice. But it is weird, you know. You think about a lot of the architects of science fiction were women with male pen names.
Oh, God, absolutely. You only have to look at James Tiptree.
Yeah.
you know, it's all there. A lot of them size that.
That's why their women characters were so strong.
Yeah, you had to make up the fact that you know, you had to face trying not to be erased by the industry.
Yeah, it's really interesting, but I don't know. It's very. I was doing a. I'm doing a series of articles on women in silent film, because women were so much more than just actors.
Yeah.
In silent film. I mean, today we have actors and writers, but then they did everything. They did stunts. They directed. They produced. They did the camera work. They. Everything you can think of that is part of film, women were as equally involved in the silent films as men.
Yeah. I mean, you probably know about the recent book, I think it came out last year, obviously later than the silent films, but the lady who basically created Creature from Black Lagoon,
mm-hmm.
written out of history,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they worked so hard. Hedy Lamarr only really
Oh, and that only came out like when her I think it was her son or somebody was talking, brought out the materials that she had done. The phone, we wouldn't have the cell phone, we wouldn't have the technology at all if it wasn't for Hedy.
Exactly. Yeah. It's amazing, really.
It's just amazing. We don't have a lot of time. How can we get your book?
Right, at the moment it's on the Zon or Amazon. That is the easiest way to get it. You can follow me on Twitter at BarbarellaFem. You can get where I got that name from.
Yeah.
Also got a website if you just look for Teresa Derwin. Teresa with a H. I mean, I'm all over social media, to be honest. In fact, on Epshaw, I'm always tweeting bad memes and stuff. But I've got to build an Amazon page. It's one of those must-do things that I've not got round to yet. But you just put my name in the search engine, or Domain Publishing, or Short Sharp Shocks. It's one of them. There were 45 books released, all of them around 10,000 words of short, nice little either horror, science fiction, or mystery. Really good little series.
How can we get in touch with you? Do you have social media?
I do. I've got the Instagram. I'm as Teresa Derwin Author. It's with a H, my name. My email, I don't mind giving that out at all. It's teresa.derwin@yahoo.co.uk. I'm on Twitter at BarbarellaFem. I'm on Facebook. Oh, God. I mean, really, all you got to do is put my name in Google. And I welcome anybody that wants to chat about books or film or horror or romance or the industry or anything. Just feel free to drop me a line.
Cool. And are you going to any conventions, or do you have any author signings or anything like that?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. I'm very, very excited, because the Horror Writers Association convention at StokerCon comes to the UK this year, and it's been 10 years since it's done that. It's held in Scarborough. I'm doing a book launch there and a book auction to help me raise funds to get to Texas to attend KillerCon in Austin in August to meet some of the Splatter community. And at StokerCon, the one in April, I'll also be giving a presentation on cult-based horror and how current politics and the world that we live in has influenced this type of horror emerging in the last 10 years, and that's part of the Anne Radcliffe Conference. So I'll be looking forward to that. That's the second week of Easter. Other than that, I'm actually going to a Supernatural convention in October, and Misha Collins over there, so I'm very excited.
Cool.
That's not a work, though. That's just
that's
like-minded fans. Gail Martin is a big Supernatural fan. So I'll be catching up with her, I hope, and she manages it.
Cool. We have come to the end. I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. I do hope you've enjoyed it.
Oh, it's been absolutely lovely. Thank you ever so much.
Thank you. And thank you for chatting with Sherry.
This is a production note. This show was recorded before the coronavirus hit the world. So I don't know what convention she mentioned that may not be happening. And so I just wanted to let you know that. Thank you for listening, and thank you for chatting with Sherry.